Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Paul Gleason with Psychiatric Times. Our guest today is Dr. James Phelps. He is a research editor at the Psychopharmacology Institute, medical director at psycheducation.org, and adjunct faculty at Samaritan Mental Health in Corvallis, Oregon. He specializes in bipolar disorder. He is the author of the book, A Spectrum Approach to Mood Disorders for Clinicians, and Bipolar, Not So Much, for Patients and Their Families. Dr. Phelps, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate the invitation and the opportunity.
All right. Well, let's begin with what drew you to psychiatry and then more specifically to bipolar disorder.
Never intended to be a psychiatrist. Originally never intended to be a physician. Got really interested in human biology and particularly neurophysiology. Was in a graduate program in neurophysiology and realized that I didn't like cutting up research animals like our crayfish every day. So moved to exercise physiology, where I thought at least we can't kill our subjects. And then discovered that I had all the requisites to go to medical school and that maybe that would give me more opportunities, particularly for teaching and research. So shifted gears, went to medical school, and was dismayed to discover that I didn't like it once I got to the clinical years. Was really grueling emotionally and was about ready to quit until I saw a psychotherapist who helped me figure out why I was struggling with that so much. So I did a year of internal medicine to really test out whether or not I'd learned what I needed to learn from her, and indeed liked it so much, I thought, maybe I could do a residency in psychiatry and do what she's doing, and became a fan of psychotherapy and its efficacy. And then later it came around to learning that bipolar disorders are one of the things in psychiatry that we are most able to help, in the sense of people being extremely ill and then getting much, much, much better. So a rewarding place to practice in terms of specialty. And that's kind of the short version of the tour.
Yeah, well, I mean, you must have been pretty interested in bipolar disorder because you were interested enough to write a book for your fellow clinicians. You know, what did you want to tell them?
So actually, it all came about indirectly in that I was trying to help my primary care colleagues cope with patients whom they could not get into our jammed up waiting list, and explaining to them that bipolarity was a spectrum thing, according to, back at that time, this was 20 years ago, people like Nasir Ghami and Fred Goodwin, who were wrote a paper in the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry in 2002 explaining this bipolar spectrum concept, and made so much sense to me. So I'm trying to share that with my primary care colleagues. And eventually I realized, you know, I can say the thing over and over again, or I could just write it down and stick it up on a website and refer them to it with all the references that I'd like them to see. And then discovered it was patients and families who were reading that website, like 10 to 1. So the website at that time was kind of unique on bipolar 2 and got very popular. Google had it number one for a long time. And so I ended up getting invited by a couple of publishing houses to write books that were like the book version of the website, both for clinicians and for patients and families. So a roundabout way to come around to writing that way.
You know, you talk about writing for your patients and their families. Are there some challenges that patients and their families are facing that maybe psychiatrists are less aware of?
Well, they have a hunger for knowledge because they have the problem right there, either in their own body or their own family. And so that hunger for knowledge is kind of, as an author, is just a kind of a delicious there. That's the patent need that I can go and try to help with. Whereas, you know, busy clinicians, a busy psychiatrist or psychotherapist, I have not experienced that hunger as broadly as from patients and families. So it's a different challenge in terms of, with psychiatrists, you kind of have to work and generate the need to know, so to speak, and kind of generate the scenarios that make people realize that they don't know things that they would like to know. And then you can show up with, oh, well, here, check out this research literature result.
Right. You know, and I was kind of wondering, you know, you've had a long career in, you know, seeing patients and a long career writing. Do writing and practicing require different skills and mindsets from you? You know, how do they compare?
Well, I hope this isn't just self-aggrandizement, but I like to think that good patient care has lots of teaching in it, in that you're trying to help patients understand all sorts of different things. And for example, when they're looking at a set of treatment options, if they're well-educated about what those options entail in terms of pros and cons, long-term benefits and risks and so on, they will then be able to, you're facilitating their choice. This is the shared decision model that's become kind of popularized nowadays. And so there's a lot of teaching there that precedes the next step in treatment. And that teaching is explaining, and explaining can be either verbal or written. And I like to think that I can sort of do about the same thing when I'm writing it down that I'm doing when I'm doing it live. And I've been fortunate to get feedback from people who read my books and say, you know, this is like I hear you talking to me, which was exactly what I was trying to achieve in those books.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of writers are trying to achieve, that sense of conversation. And I'm sure as a clinician too, the sense that you're really communicating and being understood. So the pandemic that we're going through now, has it changed practice for you?
Well, I was approaching retirement before the pandemic thing turned into such a life-changing and practice-changing experience for so many people. And so I was shaping myself toward more time for research and teaching and less time doing patient care. And all that happened just before the virus arrived. So the impact on me and my practice and my research and teaching has been really minimal compared to what I know many, many people have experienced. Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I mean, there's some talk that there may be sort of a mental health epidemic coming out of this experience. Do you think that's going to be the case?
Well, there was a mental health epidemic before the virus arrived, manifest in our area with waiting lists to see a psychiatrist and inability to get someone in to see a psychiatrist, even in crisis situations. So in that respect, well, the epidemic was already there. Will that be more pronounced? Well, yeah, I think the literature is showing us that there are more people who are experiencing particularly depression and anxiety, and a exacerbation of the severe and persistent mental illnesses, schizophrenia and bipolar one. So yeah, everything's worse. The need for psychiatry services is greater on multiple fronts, and it was already there.
Yeah. So, I mean, what do you think that either the field as a whole or individual psychiatrists can do to kind of meet this enormous need more effectively?
Well, I try not to sound like I have too facile an answer for that, but we had started to implement in our area a version of the collaborative care model, which was initiated at the University of Washington before the pandemic hit. In fact, we had it underway for several years, and that's what we were doing to try to address this mental health epidemic, because it's showing up in primary care. The primary care providers are the ones who are fielding the initial contact from so many people looking for services. So primary care is where the help is needed. Well, it's help needed all over, but that's a particularly important one. And so the collaborative care model allows us to bring mental health services right straight into primary care. Extremely important model, I think, and University of Washington is trying to facilitate its adoption across the country with a grant from Medicare and the American Psychiatric Association. So that, I think, well, that was one answer anyway that preceded the epidemic, the pandemic, and now is, I think, certainly very still appropriate.
And if your colleagues in psychiatry are interested in that, is there someplace you would recommend them going, resources they can turn to get good advice?
Well, I think the starting point for nearly anyone would be the University of Washington's educational program about collaborative care. It's called UW Ames, A-I-M-S. So if you just Google Ames Collaborative Care or UW Ames, you'll land there. And it's a soup to nuts explanation of the collaborative care model, including references and how we did it and how we now teach it. And if someone was fortunate to work in a practice model where you could hire the Ames team to come in and revise your whole system of care, they do that too. Otherwise, that's a starting point for one's own personal education about collaborative care.
Now, let's dig into the nitty-gritty of your specialty a bit on bipolar disorder. You know, back in 2018, you wrote an article for Psychiatric Times called Bipolar the Year Ahead. And you talked about, you know, six seemingly independent mechanisms, things like inflammation, stress, and mood bias. And so I'm wondering, you know, do we understand even more about bipolar now than we did back in 2018?
Well, I wish the answer was a resounding yes. And at multiple levels, it is, because there is advancing understanding. On the other hand, if one is hoping for, you know, bipolar disorder is the weirdest thing. How can one mental illness generate the opposite mood experiences, mania and depression? How can that possibly happen in terms of brain mechanisms? I hope that I stay alive long enough to hear a really good answer to that. And then you have these research findings that show that there are these different factors, the inflammation, the circadian rhythm disturbance, this mood bias, psychological bias that I think was fascinating. So whatever this switch that flips, whatever it is, it's susceptible to all these different factors. It just makes the whole thing so complicated that perhaps that helps to understand why we're not getting diabetes. Well, here, the answer is insulin. You see, insulin explains everything, that it's not going to work like that.
Alas, maybe. What about the issue of inflammation? That continues to be a hot topic.
Chuck Raison, R-A-I-S-O-N, Raison, has been doing work on inflammation and depression. He's got the best explanation for what explains depression. You know, like, why is this still around? It's potentially lethal. Why hasn't this been selected out? And his answer is, what was being selected for during the evolutionary times in which we developed these mechanisms was fighting off infection. That was the lethal thing. So you throw all your body's resources into fighting off an infection. And if you get to the point where you feel cruddy and you don't want to do anything, that's just an unfortunate byproduct of this all-out war against the invading organism. And that we still have the mechanisms in place that were evolutionarily appropriate now that we even have antibiotics, so we don't have to have all-out war, but we pay the price when you turn on that inflammatory system with a virus, with interferon as a treatment for hepatitis C, you know, is where a lot of that understanding came from. So, so that's one facet. And then there's the whole microbiome, your gut microbiome, and what's it doing in terms of potentially generating inflammatory markers or inflammatory cytokines that get into your circulation and reach the brain. It's fascinating territory.
Yeah, I mean, and along with inflammation, are there any other kind of exciting developments or in bipolar research during the last few years? I mean, any that have caught your attention in particular?
Well, our colleague John Gottlieb in Chicago was the lead author on a paper from the International Society for Bipolar Disorders on circadian rhythms and chronotherapy, using the circadian nature of bipolar disorder and to inform one's treatments. And so circadian-oriented psychotherapies and looking at the impact of things like light and something that I had a little hand in, dark therapy, as treatment modalities for bipolar disorder, social rhythm therapy as a crucial underpinning to everything that we do in the treatment of bipolar disorder. That paper was a fun experience, and being part of a team trying to pull that literature together, I think that was quite an advance.
Yeah, well, speaking of treatment, you know, I know you're interested in what you call like personal self-management of bipolar disorder. Can you tell us a bit about this approach, just what it is and why you think it's important?
Well, thank you. The social rhythm therapy is the beginning, I think. There are at least five different psychotherapies that have randomized trial evidence for their efficacy in bipolar disorder, and all of them are self-management tools of one kind or another. One is psychoeducation from the Barcelona group, striking research showing that when people understand more about their illness, they manage it better and their outcomes are vastly better for extended periods of time from a training intervention, a teaching intervention. So that's psychoeducation. But one of the those five randomized trial supported psychotherapies is social rhythm therapy. And I think the evidence is becoming clear that that is a key ingredient for nearly everyone with bipolar disorder, that it revolves around particularly a regular bedtime and a regular rise time. So having those social rhythms around sleep really nailed down has a positive impact on course of illness. One research study from Holly Swartz and colleagues suggesting that it might be basically enough to obviate the need for quetiapine that you get in bipolar two, at least, you get enough better from social rhythm therapy that adding quetiapine doesn't get you much more. Striking result from one of their studies a year or so back. So yeah, exciting work on the potential for people's management of their behaviors kind of undergirding all the treatment efforts and getting better outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and switching from the kind of what patients can do to kind of psychiatry self-reflection, I wanted to ask you about the critical psychiatry movement, which I know you've been involved in. What got you interested in it and what keeps you interested in it?
Well, thank you, Paul. It's a fascinating parallel you're drawing there between the self-management that one might need for bipolar disorder as a patient and our own self-management of ourselves. Starts with, you know, having insight into, I have a problem and I need to address it. That what I've been doing heretofore is not getting me the outcomes that I want, so I need to change. That's a fair statement of where we are in terms of psychiatry, I think. I need to examine how we've been doing on multiple fronts, and the critical psychiatry movement is facilitating our own self-reflection, I hope, in multiple domains, including, patient education before someone is offered an antidepressant is one of my particular areas of interest because of the potential that we're discovering there may be severe withdrawal when people try to stop antidepressants is much more prevalent than was recognized and much more severe in many people. So that's one. But multiple territory areas that the critical psychiatry movement has been inviting us to examine. So I guess my bottom line there is we would do well to do this just like we do psychotherapy. We listen well, and then we make sure that we reflect back to, in this case, the critical psychiatry people, that we are hearing what they are saying to us and we really understand it. And that we then examine the pros and cons of various changes that are being suggested to us.
And you mentioned one possible suggestion, which is more patient education before starting on antidepressants. Are there any other insights from critical psychiatry that you think you and your colleagues would do well to heed?
Oh, there are several of them. The next one that comes to mind is our labeling system. just the sheer recognizing the social impact on a person's life of getting a diagnosis, a diagnostic label that can be so hard to shake, and that we have to be much more careful about that. Of course, we've been careful for years and trying to dance around insurance company requirements and using some, you know, labels and not others. You know, we don't use borderline personality disorder unless we're pushed into it and so forth. We've been doing that for a long time. Bipolar disorder, for example, is another one where, boy, once someone gets that label on there, it's really hard to shake. And it can shape people's lives in ways that we did not intend. We're doing harm with our labels. And recognizing that there's no clear dividing line between clearly mentally ill and clearly absence of mental illness, shall we say, you know, the old word would be normal. And that there are all sorts of shades of gray in between, and that we need to make it clear, we're not trying to treat people who are not asking our help. I think critical psychiatry sometimes forgets that, you know, we're not out there trying to label people who are not coming to see us. On the other hand, coming to see us doesn't automatically give us permission to do whatever we think is indicated. That's still a need to collaborate with our client and avoid doing harm with our evil or even our diagnostic labeling.
Yeah, it sounds like you'd like both the kind of more conventional psychiatry and critical psychiatry to be involved in self-reflection.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's fair.
So, you know, finally, you know, you mentioned that one thing you're really hoping to see in the future is some good explanation for why something like bipolar disorder, a single condition, can have such different outcomes, like the big highs and the big lows. You know, looking forward to the next 5, 10, hopefully 20 plus years, what else are you kind of hoping to see? What are you excited about?
I have to admit, the very first thing that comes to mind is the collaborative care model. Mm-hmm. That is such a huge advance. To see that spread more widely would have a big impact on a lot of people's lives. So that's one I'm hoping really becomes, you know, normative. We have a training program in collaborative care in our residency program here at Samaritan Mental Health in Corvallis. I think it's becoming normative for residency programs to have such training programs in collaborative care. I think that's essential. So there's a big advance that I'm hoping for. And a greater recognition of the value of these psychotherapies relative to medications, so that more people get the psychotherapy that it has equal efficacy to the medications instead of the medication that has the risks and side effects that the psychotherapy doesn't. And then I guess one last one would be, there's a paper in the current JAMA Psychiatry on internet-based cognitive behavioral therapy, guided versus unguided. But the implicit finding there is that internet-based cognitive behavioral therapy has strong validity. We're just trying to figure out whether it should be guided, meaning like there's some therapist involved to some degree, or unguided, and both of them have benefit. So I think there's a sea change now in terms of a kind of a stepped care model of treatment for depression and anxiety, where you wouldn't go see even a psychotherapist for a one-to-one individual psychotherapy as the starting place. You would do an internet-based CBT, either guided or in some cases unguided, particularly for less severe depression and anxiety, according to this article that we just had come out. So internet-based CBT and trying to have a stepped care model, a public health-informed model of psychiatric and psychological services for a population, that's another one I think will be fun to watch, and I hope continue to make big advances.
Well, here's hoping that all those dreams come true in the coming years. And thank you so much again for coming on Psych Pearls.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Paul.
All right, and thank you for listening. You can find us on Psychiatric Times, the website, and also on Apple and iTunes and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Thank you again.